The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. So is Scottish independence a foregone conclusion? Perhaps not. James, today there have been two new polls showing that maybe unionism has more hope yet.
Yeah, so I think that there were 20-odd polls in a row that showed the pro-independence side ahead. And the Nationalists used to make much of this, say that this proved that independence was becoming the settled will of the Scottish people. Now, politicians always like to say that they don't talk about polls, but it's very hard for Nicola Sturgeon to say this, because she used to tweet quite enthusiastically about these polls showing independence ahead. But that narrative of that independence was becoming the kind of settled will of the Scottish people has been disrupted by the latest polling. There's another poll out today, a YouGov poll for the Times, showing the union side ahead. That follows a couple which we had earlier this week and one at the weekend showing the same thing. There's also a poll in the Scotsman suggesting that the SNP might not win an overall majority at Holyrood. Now, I think, as I said in the magazine this week, it's important to keep the shift in the polling in perspective. As one of those involved in the kind of government's attempt to save the union said to me, she couldn't have had worse headlines because of the Salmond affair. The UK government couldn't have had a better story in the vaccine rollout. And we're still looking at polls which suggest that the SNP, with the union side only a point or two ahead, and polls that suggest that the SNP might still win an overall majority after 14 years in power, an electoral system designed to stop any one party from winning an overall majority. But I do think that given where expectations got to last year, that even if the SNP come back to Holyrood as the largest party, and even if there is a pro-independence majority when combined with the Greens, the fact it is not an outright SNP majority will be seen as a setback. And I think it will make it easier for the Westminster government to argue. Initially, obviously, they will say, now is not the time for referendum with the COVID recovery. But it also allows them to say, look, when the SNP governed, were the largest party but didn't have a majority in 2007, they didn't try and hold a referendum on Scottish independence. They waited until they won an outright majority in 2011 to try and hold a referendum. And so that same logic should apply now. So I think it does show that the union is nowhere near as doomed as it looked late last year. And I think the other big worry for the yes side is what does this mean for Nicola Sturgeon? Only 35% of voters think she's been entirely honest about the Alex Salmond affair. 60% of them think she should resign if this inquiry by James Hamilton finds that she's broken the ministerial code. But if you look at the polling, so much of that rise in support for independence during the pandemic has been about Nicola Sturgeon herself and her appeal. If you end up in a situation where she goes as First Minister at some point, either because of the Salmond affair or because the SNP do not meet the sky-high expectations for them in the election and she decides not to carry on, or her party, a faction of her party moves against her, then I think the independence cause will be in a much weaker position than it is now. And I think what it shows is that the union has much more of a chance than it looked like. This narrative of inevitability has been broken.
Katie, how much of this is down to the Alex Salmond, Nicola Sturgeon civil war, do you think? So it's finally cutting across to voters?
I think it's down to a series of factors. I remember having a conversation with a Scottish Tory who made the point when, this is I think a month or so ago, and I was saying, well, there are a few signs that actually unionism, not exactly making a comeback, but the landscape is improving for it. One of which was the Salmond case, but also the vaccines, the fact that it's seen as a UK-wide project. You also had infighting with the SNP following Joanna Cherry's department, which, yes, she's seen as an Alex Salmond ally, but also that was about infighting over the trans issues and a debate within the party. And they made the point that with some parties are normally in politics, you just see one quite bad scandal to really dent them. But they felt the SNP needed several. When I see this polling, I think that clearly, I think the way that the questions over Nicola Sturgeon and her role in terms of the Salmond inquiry has proved damaging to the SNP to an extent. I also think that there have been other things that have played a role here, which is just that as the general outlook improves, if both for Scotland and the rest of the UK, I think that one of the things that was helping independence previously was the fact that Nicola Sturgeon's handling of the pandemic was seen in a much more positive light than Boris Johnson's, particularly by Scottish voters. Even though actually he looked at the hard facts, there wasn't such a huge difference in terms of probably the statistics or the data in terms of hospital admissions or deaths. You had a situation where, because Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister, appeared more cautious in focus groups, her handling was seen as a much more adult or mature way of doing it. And lots of Scottish Tories cannot stand the daily press conferences she does, which she never misses, because they thought they were becoming party broadcasters and really helping with that. So I think that the fact that the pandemic, fingers crossed at least, appears to be easing, and you have the vaccine project, which initially I think was a little bit slower in Scotland, has now caught up. I think there is a sense that that has landed as a UK project, and people think that the fact that we are ahead on vaccines, whereas countries like the EU are behind, not because there are celebrations on that, I don't think that is where the majority of the voters are, but like it is seen as something which, whether it's conscious or not, is a union project rather than an independent Scotland one. So I think that's also playing a role here.
James, on your point about Nicola Sturgeon being a large part of the appeal for SNP voters, what happens if she is taken out? Does the SNP have other charismatic leaders in waiting? Katie, for example, had Kate Forbes, the finance minister, on the Women with Balls podcast not so long ago.
I think Kate Forbes is, you know, she's only 30 years old. She's finance minister of Scotland. She stepped in the most remarkable circumstance, having to deliver a budget almost straight away, and did that with aplomb. I think one of the issues for her would be, one of the big dividing lines in the SNP at the moment is about trans rights and culture wars. Kate Forbes is a member of the Free Church of Scotland. She has strong views on the trans question. That might make it hard for her to rally that particular wing of the SNP to her as leader. And I think this is one of the problems for the SNP, which is, you know, if it's not Nicola Sturgeon, who is it? You know, they've had John Swinney, but that, I think, would look very much back to the future. And I think also he has been damaged by the salmon effect. You know, he survived it. There was a vote of no confidence in him in the Scottish Parliament yesterday because of the reluctance to hand over the legal advice. Lots of people talk about the prospects of Angus Robertson, the SNP's former Westminster leader. He lost his seat at Westminster, but he's standing for the Scottish Parliament election. Scottish Parliament this May is expected to win, and people think, you know, maybe he could do it. But if you are trying to move on decisively from the Alex Salmond, Nicola Sturgeon clash, given how much meat has been made of the fact that, you know, Angus Robertson knew about the Edinburgh Airport incident, I don't think it gives you that distance. So, no, and I think it is true. I mean, I think one of the most, Katie was talking about the Nicola Sturgeon press conferences. One of the remarkable things is she always does them. This isn't like the kind of the UK government ones where different cabinet ministers come in depending on what the area is. It is the Nicola Sturgeon show. And I think that shows both her strength, but also, if one was to kind of whisper quietly, the fact that she is there, sometimes flanked by other people, sometimes not, is also, I think, kind of, to whisper it quietly, a kind of sign that the bench strength of the SNP is not that great.
And Katie, we've been talking on this podcast this week about the row over the NHS pay rise, or lack thereof in real terms. And the latest development today is that former Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt has waded into the row.
Yes, Jeremy Hunt has suggested the 1% pay offer to NHS staff is a miscalculation. He is obviously a former health secretary, but chair of the Health Select Committee. This is interesting in the sense of, will there be a U-turn? Figures in government are very keen, which I find very curious, to say that even were they to move away from the 1%, it would not be a U-turn, because nothing's confirmed right now. So nothing to see here. But I think it's an interesting one in the sense, because this isn't due until May, you've got Rishi Sunak today talking before the Treasury Select Committee, where he's described the 1% pay increase as affordable and said that's ultimately the main factor here. You had Lord Bethell, a health minister, say earlier this week that nurses were well paid for the job they did. I don't think that's a government script. That's moving away from the government script. I think the message they want to land is obviously that money is tight, and that is why they're not getting a higher pay rise, but they do deserve one. So I think what the health minister said was off message. But generally speaking, in terms of where this goes, I think the thing that you're hearing more is, why if the door is ajar? Why if there could be movement on this is the government continually defending the 1% pay rise. At this point, we've had the Prime Minister defend it, Rishi Sunak's defended it, I think Matt Hancock has defended it, Health Minister defending it. There is a question as to whether, if they are going to move before May, is it worth taking all the criticism and the build-up to that? Perhaps they're not going to move, but increasingly MPs think they are going to have to move. And we talked about the ways that they want them to move on previous podcasts. And I think that Jeremy Hunt is coming forward too shows that this is, I think it does suggest this could be more widespread. And we've got weeks for the discontent to grow on the issue. I do think that when it comes to affordability, there is another question, which is, where are Tory MPs in terms of spending? The budget landed generally quite well, actually, despite all the warnings ahead about raising corporation tax. MPs were, you know, threatening to go against our confidence issue, but they went along with it. But you have someone like Jeremy Hunt, who has been critical of the foreign aid cut, which is yet to be voted on, could be voted on Parliament, has been pro the defence budget increase and is against the nurses' pay. And I think one of the frustrations in government is that MPs are not coming up with where they think there could be savings or tax raises, but in a way that's slightly separate, because I think the issue of nurses' pay is MPs do just feel like this could be turned into free school meals, and it's painful.
James, what's the answer to Katie's question? Why should the government be backing itself a bit more just in case there is a change in policy down the line?
I think the timing of the announcement of the 1% offer was strange. It seemed weird to step on the budget by doing it the day after. So, you know, there was no kind of parliamentary or legal necessity to do it on the day they did. I thought that was strange. I think they are giving themselves a little bit of wiggle room with, you know, look, we'll wait to see what the independent pay review body comes back with. I think one of the things that gets lost in this debate, because the government is only offering 1%, is that the Royal College of Nurses wants 12.5%. That's a kind of challenge here. You know, what increase would have been met with everyone saying, that's fine. You know, if they'd gone for 2%, when everyone said, oh yes, that seems very reasonable. And I think one of the other problems for the government is the big question about what public opinion will think about this, I think depends on what happens to private sector employment. But the furlough doesn't come to an end until the end of September. And until that moment, I don't think we really will know what the picture is on private sector employment. I think that, you know, if we fast forward to the end of this year, if the furlough has come to an end and lots of businesses have deemed not to be viable, laid staff off, if the economic recovery has been a bit more sluggish than people expected, then, you know, people might think that 1% for nurses is more reasonable. But if you got kind of big rapid bounce back in growth, if more jobs were saved because, you know, lots of people started going back to the office, you know, lots of those city centre jobs were saved for that, then I think people might think that you know, 1% for these people who worked so hard during COVID, you know, I think that's hard. I suspect that if there is a government U-turn, it would be along the lines that Katie outlined on Coffee House in the one-off payment. Because the benefit of a one-off payment is it is one-off. I think, you know, what the institutional treasury always worries about is things becoming kind of long-term and permanent and impossible to unwind. The benefit of a one-off COVID thank you payment to NHS staff is once it had been paid out, it would be done.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And do join us again tomorrow.